The thing is that everybody plays a role in being able to make life more livable for all humans and make it your mission to create a world that works for everyone. And whereas you see that the world is not working for everyone, and specifically it's not working for certain individuals consistently, start to do the work to inquire why. And if you can at least just do that, then you're on your way.
One of the beautiful things that has risen through this COVID-19 isolation for me has been learning how to record remotely. Of course, it's had its growing pains, but one of the best things about recording remotely is that my guest list isn't limited to who I can physically sit with. As I continue on my anti-racism journey, I found several accounts on Instagram that have taught me so much. When you follow a hashtag on Instagram, photos will often come up on your feed that will lead you to a profile that you may not have come across before. This is what led me to Dr. Tiffany Bowden's profile. Welcome to the Safe Haven, a space for stories to be shared about the lights and darks, highs and lows of life. At the top of Tiffany's page, it says, anti-racism educator, TED speaker, cannabis, tech, and mental health influencer. Well, myself, as a TED Talk lover who is chasing the depths of anti-racism very actively and understanding how I can help dismantle the systemic and systematic racial structures of our society, as well as having my own struggles understanding the different perspectives around cannabis use, all of these points sparked my interest. I started the conversation with Tiffany by asking her the question, how did you get into working with cannabis?
That's such a good question. I'll tell you what, it wasn't a likely entry into the space. It actually was, the case that I entered as an advocate before I entered in any other kind of a way first, because I had a family member that was sick and they had confided in me that they were utilizing cannabis to support themselves. And I actually had a negative reaction to that. I didn't have a positive reaction because, you know, I grew up under the propaganda that cannabis was bad. And if you did cannabis, you were going to get on other drugs, possibly die. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had very out there kind of views because I grew up in conservative environments as it related to the topic. And so then it was only through observing them where I was able to see their medications start to diminish and see more of their personality being able to come through that I was able to identify that, oh, maybe there's more here. And so with that, once they passed away, I decided to, take a further look into, why was it that I had such a negative reaction in the first place. My background had been in marketing and advertising previously, and I had done a lot of work on studying the representation of Black people in advertising. And so, I thought that what I was doing was going to be breaking from that and then just dedicating study to cannabis. And what ended up happening is that I ended up coming full circle again, right back to racism once I understood that, the war on drugs was actually rooted in racism. And that was a fun fact that I didn't have at the time when I embarked on that journey. I was completely and perfectly willing to surrender that space of inquiry and going into the direction to honor, my lost loved one and to confront my own ignorance about the topic. So, to kind of come full swing back into, understanding racism was just like a whole, mind blow, if you will. Mm-hmm. So then thereafter, I had my own personal experiences as someone who had suffered a spinal fracture. It was a very strange kind of injury in that I hadn't fallen. There was nothing like that occurred. But I still had this injury that was deeply impacting and it hurt me for like quite some time. And there was like no support for it. I was taking different opioids. I was taking, didn't end up taking the opioids. They had gotten recommended to me, but I was actually really kind of terrified of going down the rabbit hole. And I had taken, other medications that they had recommended but they weren't even really scratching the pain. So because they weren't scratching the pain, I was actually really afraid of, you know, having something that actually would work, but then my body craving more and more of it, which is what happens to a lot of people when they get addicted to opiates. So being armed with that knowledge on the front end, I just started to explore other methods, and that included adjusting my nutrition, essential oil, yoga, massage, also cannabis by way of a topical. At that particular time, taking any kind of psychoactive cannabis actually made my pain worse, because what cannabis can also do is make you hyper aware of what's going on. And that was what was happening. And so, but when I did discover cannabis topicals and how they just completely took pain away, it gave me my life back. And that's where I really kind of sinked in, like on a whole different level, and started advocacy on a different phasing. Now, prior to any of that, I had already started a cannabis education company. And I had founded a nonprofit organization, the Minority Cannabis Business Association, to essentially provide education and opportunity to people who were interested in that space. And ultimately, people have been talking a lot about, you know, people getting into the cannabis industry, Black people and women in particular. But a lot of folks don't really talk about what happens to us when we're here. And I will say that my journey in through the cannabis industry was so brutal. It was so brutal, even with the successes that I had, it was so traumatic. I suffered so many losses, business theft from people that I brought to my own table. That I really shut down, and that just kind of launched into a whole different passion for mental health, because I had to kind of pull myself up from the ground, if you will. My journey with cannabis is a complicated one, filled with wins, losses, and lessons.
Oh my gosh. I wrote down a couple things as you were talking there, and even business theft. How did that happen? What happened there?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting story. So, you know, this is a story that it's really the origin story is me not knowing my power, not knowing my self-worth. And there was an abusive relationship that was in the wings there that I just didn't really have a vision for. I didn't know it. Like, I've come from, you know, great men and love in my life. I've had a wonderful father who passed away. I had a wonderful grandfather who passed away. And then I had a lovely significant other who got killed in a hit and run car accident. And all of this happened back to back to back. And so, as you can imagine, my heart was broken. And, we don't necessarily talk as much about mental health in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't necessarily a thing like, okay, I need to take some time and heal. Like, I mean, it was like, you know, even when it was brought up, it was like, what am I going to counseling for? I'm supposed to be sad. Like, you know, people might have elevated like medication. Like, I don't want to, you know, not be able to feel sadness. Like, I'm sad, and there's valid reasons. And I just didn't really understand it at all. And so I kind of sank in that grief and it stayed unresolved. And then I ended up going to, into fitness and the gym and trying to rebuild myself because I was like, I can't stay down, you know. And I trained for a fitness competition. And one of the people that were on my team, that they ended up being my new significant other and then eventually my business partner. But then it was kind of one of those sweeping romances, which at the time felt amazing because they just kind of seemed to come in and be perfect and like everything was amazing. And, because I didn't have any history with any nefarious anything, I didn't really have a guard up. And it was that deep level of trust that ultimately would set me up later for failure, as well as my not knowing of my self-worth. So the way that showed up was that, you know, the person said that they wanted to invest in me, and that sounded amazing. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. And they said, well, what do you want? And I said, well, I want to have business before I graduate college. So they said, okay, well, I'm going to help make that happen. Well, I launched my first cannabis business as a student. And, you know, I didn't make a lot of money as a student. You know, you're working for the university and they don't even let you have another job. So I was broke. And here I had a man that, you know, made six figures. So in my mind at that particular time, that was like a lot of money. And it still is a lot of money, but it was just like a inaccessible amount of money in my brain at that time. And what ultimately ended up happening is that he said that he would be my investor and we'd be 50-50. And I said, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, so he would put up all the money, all the cost, and then I would do all the work. And that seemed fair to me at the time. And what that ended up looking like was that my first event cost $1,000. And then I made $17,000 off of that $1,000. And I worked, you know, 7 days a week, pretty much all day to do that. Then the next event, we took that same $17,000 because there were no cash outs, rolled it into another event. And the money from those events became profitable as well. So it would be like, you know, you're taking $17,000, you're turning that into $30,000, you're taking, you know, 5,000 and turning it into 50,000, taking the 50,000, turning it into 135. But, you know, all the money is being reinvested. Mm-hmm. Now, because the person was also in finance, I just entrusted them with all the money and with the bank accounts and such. And lo and behold, they had set up the bank in some, you know, very strange way as like a DBA of their name. They had all the accesses to, you know, my logins. They ended up stealing the domain to the website. They hijacked that domain, locked me out of my email drives, which also contained my PhD research. So they held my PhD research hostage and said that if I wanted to graduate, then I would give them all of my business resources, which I turned over business resources and they still didn't give me my PhD research. They then, you know, used that same domain to hijack the nonprofit organization that I was a part of. You know, and I, and that nonprofit, the way that they were able to do that is because I was the founder of that organization and it, and the domain was in the same GoDaddy account. So, you know, I reached out to the person who was my co-founder for the nonprofit organization for assistance and solidarity. And that person was also a man. These are two black men, by the way, that I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. They, you know, he basically called me a male blamer, said I was being dramatic, didn't believe me even after sharing with him a police report and me explaining the context because the individual had been violent against me as well. So it was a very lonely space because, you know, this was my first time ever actually confiding that I was in any kind of an abusive dynamic. And the first person to hear it just didn't believe me. And I didn't know how to hold that. And I shut down. So then I went silent. And then all these abuses started happening to me behind the scenes. And I was getting bullied. But I had not had that language. I was getting basically cyber bullied, business bullied, and by people that I knew, by people that I had loved at some point. And, you know, my relationship was also, you know, basically abusive. You know, there'd been violence, there had been theft, over, you know, $35,000 taken off my credit cards, over $160,000 out of the company, and my PhD research on hold. So, you know, so I was devastated. It took me so far down. I was eating out of food pantries, you know, and my life was just upside down, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that space, I really had to kind of come to a time where, like, I mean, my dad is the one who ultimately saved me from this debacle 6 years after he had actually passed away, which is, I know, kind of a crazy thing to hear, but like he came back to me in a dream and ultimately gave me the communication to let go. And as an athlete previously, I had always gotten the communication of, you know, never quit, you know? And so I was just kind of dragging myself down. And what my dad kind of had to come and round out for me is like, yes, never quit, but always let go. And he had to break that distinction down for me, is that quitting is when you've left something on the table, and letting go is, you know, when you're walking away from something that no longer serves you anymore. Mm-hmm. And he was just letting me know it was time for me to let go. So I started that let go process and started to just kind of try to make my peace with everything. And, you know, I came to a point where it was like, okay, well, either I win or I learn, I never lose. And so anytime that I perceived that I was losing something, I instead forced myself to get the lesson behind it. And that lesson ended up becoming a curriculum that I built. And that's called Business Self-Defense. So that's a course that I have coming, forthcoming. It is as much about law and business as it is about empowerment, because what I do know is that even if I had done, you know, all the things, you know, correctly from a business standpoint, things would have gone wrong because of where I was holding myself before, you know, I had met any of these individuals. Because who you are ultimately is how you show up in your business. Like, if you don't have proper boundaries, if you don't have a proper self-evaluation, then you're going to do things like underprice yourself. You're going to do things like have customer service policies and protections for people outside of your business, but not have an operating agreement to protect yourself. You're going to, you know, do so many things that you're already doing to yourself, and you're just going to teach other people how to do that to you. Mm-hmm. So it became so important for me to get myself healthy, get myself strong, and then to be able to help others avoid these pitfalls. And that's ultimately kind of how I also became an advocate for mental health, and to speak loudly, even more loudly than I had in the past, about diversity and inclusion issues.
I am borderline speechless. For someone who is never at a loss for words, there's so much to unpack there.
I know.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I have a couple questions though. So when you were, how long did you stay in this relationship, or were you still in this relationship with this man who was holding your PhD and the money and all of this, and in this abusive relationship, up until that 6-year point after your dad had passed, when you had that dream? Were you still with that guy?
Yeah, I was. So basically, as it is with most relationships that are kind of termed narcissistic abuse, mm-hmm. You don't really have a specific end point. Basically, things went wrong when I communicated that I didn't want to be with said individual. And then they started to exert control and force over me, and then act as if I never said anything at all. So there were still constant daily interactions and constant text messages and all these kinds of things that were going on. So it wasn't like a clear, this person is like cut. Mm-hmm. But then once they had stolen all of my business and my money and my assets, then they themselves ghosted me, and then just continued to run my business, which it's still up. It's called Comfy Tree Enterprises. So you can, if you Google Comfy Tree Enterprises or Comfy Tree Cannabis Academy, you can see all the press from what I've done in the past. But if you were to go to the business Comfy Tree, I don't have any access to it. And he's actually changed it over to Kentucky Cannabis Synopsism. And he's changed it over a few times, you know. But yeah, I was with the individual, you know, from, I want to say 2012. And then he locked me out of my company. There had been gradual lockouts that were happening between 2015 and 2016. Mm-hmm. You know, so all of this had been, you know, going on, and my dad basically came to me. It was like Christmas Eve, you know. I was like tormented. I was a tormented soul. And then he came to me, and then in that dream, and just told me to let go in 2016. And I did. I let it go, and I went to the bank, and I signed over, you know, my company. Basically, what it was is I was getting demanded ransom, an extortive request from this individual. He had stolen about $64,000 from me. And the deal was, he would give me $64,000 to buy me out of my company, which that's not a real actual offer. And so as I was pushing back on that, he would just say, oh, too late. Now the offer is $35,000. And then when I would sign these things, he would always say, nope, too late. He never countersigned anything and never actually agreed to anything. So even as I agreed, you know, to just like, look, I'm just going to be exploited. I'm basically agreeing to be extorted and threatened and, you know, pushed out of my own space because my mental health is suffering. And at the end of the day, there is nothing more valuable than my mind. So, you know, I'm just going to cut my losses and whatever. He wouldn't even follow through with that because he just was like on a winner take all type of thing. He never gave me a single dime. I never made a single dime off of my company. I actually incurred a significant amount of debt because of all the identity theft. I had $35,000 on my credit cards, and I had to work myself out of that hole without a website, without, you know, any kind of anything, and with paying these creditors every single month, by just bootstrapping and, you know, pulling from my mind, you know, and just building with like a $0 investment. And I've built like an excessive like network. I got my TED Talks and all these other things while I was in the process of climbing out of that hole. Like when you're in that hole and you just have a deep desire to be on top, it's amazing what kind of things can come out of your mind. You know, so it's been a very, very, very long and complicated journey. But yeah, I was navigating that individual, and, you know, he pops up every now and then to kind of taunt or to, you know, kind of try to put tripwire there. But by and large, I'm clear from that situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have done so many wonderful things since then, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I've been following along. You are one resilient woman. I mean, so many people would give up after that and you wouldn't know where to start. So wait, okay, timestamp me here. It was 2012 when you finally started to let go. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, 2012. Well, no, 2012 is when. So 2009 is when my grandfather died. 2011 is when my father died. Mm-hmm. 2012 is when my significant other died in a hit and run car accident. And literally within that same year, I got into a relationship with this individual, which in my case was not wise because I was not fully healed. But he kind of like saw that and just kind of, you know, kind of moseyed on in. But then 2016 is where, you know, I got the dream from my father.
Okay.
And it's also when I got locked out of my company in complete form, although there were elements that I was getting locked out since 2015, at least. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I started to let go at that point. And once I started to do that letting go process, I started letting other things in.
Mm-hmm. Your business self-defense course, when did you start establishing that, the curriculum for that?
When I was in the hole, basically. It was like, you know, when I was in like severe depression, severe anxiety, feeling of defeat, feeling of like, I can't let this person win, and was perceiving myself as, you know, losing. That's basically when that happened. Basically, you know, my father used to be a professional athlete. And I grew up as an athlete, and, you know, I'd always had high grades. And so I was used to winning, and in sports culture teaches you a whole lot about winning. And so does business culture. But nobody actually teaches you how to lose. And I didn't know how to lose. I didn't know how to lose. And I didn't want to even say it to myself because I, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I'm a winner. I'm not going to let him win. Mm-hmm. And I also had come from a culture of never give up. So I thought that if I were to let up, that somehow it was like against my identity to do. And therefore I was robbing myself of peace. But at every particular point where I perceive myself as losing something, it could be like, you know, he's hijacked the domain and he has used the domain to commit identity fraud in X, Y, and Z reasons. Okay, well, now I have learned the lesson about, you know, these domains and what their significance is, as well as, you know, certain lessons within trademark and all that. It was almost like taking myself through law school.
Yeah.
And I documented every single thing about all those things. And whenever I was like screaming for an attorney, they told me, no, you don't need an attorney. You need a book deal. This is beyond, like, mm-hmm. you know, lawsuit. This is, you need a book or a movie deal. And, you know, like, it was very dramatic. Like, the things that I had gone through were very dramatic. But, you know, I'm grateful to be on this side of it.
Mm-hmm. Especially now when I, like I said, when I was going through your website, and I'm looking at everything that you have accomplished in your life. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And even just having been on TED stages, I want to know this story too. How mm-hmm. you are officially on the TED roster. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that was a really amazing experience. I've done a few TED Talks. I've actually received an award for Top 5 People's Choice Award. My first TED was actually called Beware of Balloons, and it's part stand-up bit, part talk about the ridiculousness of cannabis laws. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I addressed race and racism and all of that, but just did it in a very kind of funny way. That one I haven't seen recorded in up yet, but there is a TED conversation that's recorded. That's what my coloring book taught me about racism. Mm-hmm. And my talk, my poem, Coloring Book, is one that has been really well received by a lot of people because it's non-threatening, but it's also like very like heart-based, and it's also very real in terms of my expressions of racism. It comes from a heart space rather than the way that we try to tackle racism from a very heady space. And we mm-hmm. want to understand it from a mental space, but it's different in that it comes from that heart space of understanding. But, you know, I've really loved my time with TEDs so far.
Do you have any plans on speaking with them anytime soon?
Yeah. You know what? I've been so busy just with like everything else that's been going on because, you know, my work is for the community. I've been out here as an advocate for years, and I love what I do, especially for doing anti-racism work. Like, this is kind of new for a lot of people, but this is not new for me. I've mm-hmm. been at this for at least more than 20 years. And, you know, I've been able to, you know, create diversity interventions for companies such as Apple and Groupon and, you know, Amazon and McDonald's, Procter & Gamble. And so I've been in those kinds of spaces in addition to nonprofit spaces like National Underground Railroad, Freedom Center. Mm-hmm. And that's in addition to my work in the entrepreneurial space, where I'm doing specific trainings for organizations, diversity and inclusion workshops, allyship trainings, and, you know, just individualized things.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love, just a couple seconds ago, you said something about how your heart has to be in it. If I've learned yeah. anything about this anti-racism journey, it's that it's heart work. It's hard work, but it's yeah. heart work. Yes. Your heart has to be in the right place for it. So I love that you just touched on that.
Your heart definitely has to be in it. And a lot of people, I think, have been kind of, you know, coming from a place of their minds. They mm-hmm. they want to mm-hmm. understand it mentally. Mm-hmm. And that's not what, it's okay to take it from that space and understand it. But if you don't ever feel it, if you don't ever feel the fact that there are some human beings that don't feel safety in their bodies, and it's because the color of their skin, mm-hmm. and it's because they actually are literally seeing people that look like them die. If you mm-hmm. don't see and if you don't feel that there are some people that are afraid to leave their homes, and that is because of a history of things being used against them because of the color of their skin. And if you can't really feel, you know, the generalized anxiety that people of color and Black people specifically feel when they go into office spaces and they experience microaggressions, it's like you are missing out on an aspect of your humanness, and then you open yourself up for spiritual bypassing. Mm-hmm. And spiritual bypassing is not something that, you know, a lot of people understand, nor do they spend a whole lot of time with. But it is certainly something that, you know, we really, really need, you know, to kind of take more of an account towards, because what it ultimately ends up doing is covering over the things that we really need to sit with.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, the spiritual bypassing?
Spiritual bypassing, it's basically the tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, or unfinished developmental tasks. You know, as it relates to white supremacy and anti-racism work, it can look like explaining away racism and white privilege by way of, say, abundance mindsets or law of attraction, or, you know, let go and let God, or, you know, maybe they attracted that life, or they just have negative energy, or whatever. I mean, any of these kind of fill in the blank kinds of things, those things also need to be challenged. It's okay to have a spiritual framework. I believe in spirituality, but these spaces are also not immune to having some tough conversations about race and racism. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about microaggressions.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading a lot about very common microaggressions that a lot of people may say or use commonly without realizing them. And one that has surprised me that I can't quite wrap my head around in, because I've always thought that no matter what color your skin is, to be called articulate, I've always thought that that was a, like a compliment, because I know if someone ever calls me articulate, I'm like, thanks. So I'm trying to wrap my head around why or how calling someone articulate is a microaggression. I would love for you to give your opinion on that.
Yeah, so it's specifically a microaggression when we call Black people articulate, or saying, "Oh, you speak so well," and it's kind of like, "Well, how are you expecting us to speak? Like, did you expect us not to be able to have a command of English, or, you know, what exactly is going on?" Like, for it's probably easier to illustrate. Like, I know of instances where, you know, there's been people that have spoken to Asian Americans, people who have been born here, and they may be speaking to someone, and then someone will say, like, "Oh, you speak really good English." And it's like, well, you know, I am from here, and I speak English as a first language. Of course I speak good English. You know, it's the unnecessary commentary and regulation of how someone is showing up and presenting. That's basically where you start to get into the microaggression.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that makes more sense. I guess it's just kind of like this, because when I recorded a couple weeks ago with a girlfriend of mine, and we were talking just about being articulate, and I never really thought about it. And then a couple weeks later, when I was hearing about this, or considered a microaggression, just trying to wrap my head around that, I guess I didn't really consider the usage of that word depending on the context. I think that I just needed to wrap my head around the context and the use of it to actually see it as a microaggression. Okay, well, that makes.
And I'll say that, you know, it's usually white people that are communicating to Black people that they're articulate. Like, if you kind of see that as it's used in pop culture, Black people are often the ones that are being commented on that they are so articulate. You'll see those kinds of, like, you wouldn't go up to like a white person and be like, "Oh, you speak English well." Like, that would just be really weird.
Right. Like, well, you know? but then it's funny, because then I would totally use that to say that, you know, one of my guests a couple of weeks ago, very white woman, is very articulate. And I just, I love the way that she speaks, and she's so eloquent, and she's able to speak so clearly, and her message comes across well, and it's easy to digest. I guess maybe that's why that's a word that I've kind of picked up as something, obviously, because I'm in the podcast industry too, right?
Yeah.
So when I speak to people, just that natural rapport that you can build, or that level of communication that you can just banter back and forth with someone where they are articulating a message or a story or an experience so clearly that you don't really have to ask too much more, because they've just communicated it so clearly. I guess maybe I've just been using it interchangeably, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's important to kind of have these intimate understandings of cultural nuance, because what's offensive in one community doesn't necessarily land that way in another community, because, you know, language and culture, they have their divergences, and then they have their shared points. So, you know, it's all about the nuance.
Yeah. Thank you so much for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Pre-recording, you and I were talking a bit about mental health, and you brought it up just when you were talking about how after you had three significant losses in your life in a row, like bam, 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 you know, you're having these issues with your business, so much is happening. I'm just curious on any personal practices that you have to help balance and maintain your own mental health.
Well, I certainly have a good handle on my work-life balance. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't take a phone into my bedroom. I had recently started to do that because of just like needing to have an alarm because of all the things that are kind of going on. But I'm actively in the process of getting an actual old school alarm clock because I don't want to have technology, you know, in my room. I want to be able to make my room a space of rest. It's really important for me to also have a division and separation of walls to be able to separate space. So that does bring in a kind of a class privilege where it's like, for me, studios are really a challenge because it's harder for me with some of the disability that I have, as well as just like my past things. Like I don't live in those kind of spaces very well. But I do also understand that for some, that's the only option that exists. And so I totally get that. Where I can, I try to have spaces that can have some division. Additionally, essential oils have been some lifesavers for me. Vetiver in particular has been very grounding for me. Lavender, not as much. You know, people would actually, you know, recommend lavender to calm me down when I was like really in it. And as it turned out, you know, lavender was almost kind of offensive to my nose. But what I really needed for that emergency essential oil was vetiver. It kind of almost smells like the earth, and it gives you a space of like, this is where the ground is, and you're able to pull yourself back to home. If anybody's ever been like in a severe panic attack kind of space, they know exactly what I'm referring to, where you just need a place to be able to ground in, and that scent really does that. Also, sensory deprivation, saltwater float tanks are amazing. Not only were they very healing for my back when I had the fractured spine situation, but they also helped me to empty my mind. It's kind of almost like guided meditation, being submerged in a pool, kind of weightless, you know, so those things are really good. But then there's also the things that you don't really need anybody else for, or you don't need any kind of financial supports for, because some of those things require, you know, all those things in a way have a kind of class privilege element to it because you have to purchase those things. So what I like to elevate to people is that, you know, meditation and being silent and going into yourself and getting to a space where you are comfortable in your silence, where you're comfortable sometimes with being uncomfortable, because sometimes, you know, that's what we really need to acknowledge. Sometimes we really need to just stop running from the discomfort of our experience and just kind of sit in it and feel it so that we can move through things. And that doesn't cost a dime. And you can do that anywhere that you are. And that is actually my favorite practice. My second would probably be journaling, you know, because being able to just get my words out of my head and doing it by way of a free write, not letting my hands stop writing. I think that that's a very valuable practice where you can learn how to silence your inner critic, and as well as, you know, how to just move past external critics as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The voice that is between our ears is constant, isn't it?
It is. It is. And if you can learn how to shut that one up for, you know, 10 minutes at a time, you're doing some great things.
So do you meditate and journal every day then?
I do. I do meditate and journal every day. And that's been a practice that I have recovered from childhood. I had fallen off the wagon, you know, where I had stopped doing either. But what that looked like to me is that I stopped talking to myself. When you stop talking to yourself and you lose track of what you think and what you feel and where you are, and you stop checking in, and then combine that with, you know, dealing with some difficult personalities or, God forbid, an abusive relationship. And now you end up lost in the sauce because you don't even know where you are. You don't know what your thoughts and feelings are. And now you're having all this information being thrust upon you. So it's so important to have a practice where you know who you are, you know where you stand, and you validate yourself rather than having only extrinsic validation sources.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I could talk to you all all day long. I love this so much. Okay, I have a couple questions for you. Mm-hmm. I'd love to know what you're reading.
Let's see. I'm reading Nikki Giovanni. She is my favorite poet. I have a poem of hers here. It's like very brief that I would love to share.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah, it's called Mercy, and I think that it's appropriate for the time, and it's appropriate for what we have been dealing with like the police brutality and mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter and all that. But it's called Mercy. She asked me to kill the spider. Instead, I got the most peaceful weapons I can find. I take a cup and a napkin. I catch the spider and put it outside and allow it to walk away. If I'm ever caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, just being alive and not bothering anyone, I hope I'm greeted with the same kind of mercy. So this is like a poem. It's on the same page with, there's some other notable poets that are on there, like Rudy Francisco as well. I just think that the poem just really speaks to a kind of grace that we need to have with each other, that we're all just trying to kind of move through and do the very best that we can. And sometimes we come into conflict with each other, and it's not by intention. It's just that we're all stumbling around trying to get through this thing called life together. And there's these Venn diagrams of collisions and experiences. And from our own, humanness and our own seat of being, we can only see our own world. And, when other people kind of stumble into it, we can kind of get affronted or afraid or whatever triggers there are about how they are coming up and showing up into our world. It's really important to just remember that we are all simply human beings, mm-hmm. and we're really just doing our best and, to really just try to give each other mercy and grace and love, so that we can get to that space of connectedness. If we can have empathy for individuals, even something as, as small as a spider, it starts to put a ripple effect in place that changes the whole world. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately where we need to kind of drive to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was, mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. I love that you were able to connect that to just the fact that we are all here being. Mm-hmm. Like if we're not causing harm, just let us be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that one, exactly. And that poem, it's an adapted version from Nikki's poem. They're both very similar. Mm-hmm. I love both of them. But I think that they get that one is called Mercy and one is called Allowables. But I think that, really kind of getting versed in those kind of works, like when we're saying, okay, listen to people. Mm-hmm. It's not just about listening to the people that are in your life. It's not just about listening to people when you're in an argument. It's not even just listening to the talking heads. Art activism is another powerful space of listening. It's a space where you can listen in your heart to other people who are in their emotions and in their heart space. It's important that we save those spaces. Where people are boldly feeling their feelings mm-hmm. about these things, we need to be able to continue to support those things. So that's another way that we can kind of honor that listening.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great perspective. That's I never thought of that as a way of listening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it totally is.
It totally is. You go to an art museum where there's a curation. Or black artists, they are certainly telling you, they're not telling you, they're showing you, mm-hmm. they are feeling into what it is to be marginalized. They are feeling into what it is to experience injustice, and they are crying into their art, and they are inviting you to share in that experience. And that is a different experience from just simply being told a bunch of statistics. And I think that those spaces are even more powerful because it gets you back in touch with yourself being a human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like we mm-hmm. mentioned earlier, that heart work. Mm-hmm. Instead, that's just like a direct chat with the heart.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love this. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my three safe haven style questions for you are... What are you most proud of?
Most proud of Being the maid of honor for my friend's wedding, I think that that's like the proudest moment. Even though I've had all these different accomplishments that people would put on their wall, you know, that is, I would say, by far something that ranks really high up there, because what it means is that I've been able to show up for somebody consistently to the point that they would want for me to be by their side on their, you know, one of their most important days of their lives. And it's just a badge of honor to be able to know that I've done that and I've been able to honor someone in that way.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. What would you like to be known for?
You know, I want to be known for love. And when I say love, the way that I love is nuanced. Sometimes it's nurturing love, and sometimes it is tough love. And you know, it is through love that I build connection and that I help people with breakthrough and transformation. It's through love that I help people connect back into their why, and I help them to launch their visions, their dreams, their goals. And I love you enough to check you. I love you enough to offend you. And that offense is not going to stop me from loving you. Your frustration, you know, or disagreement is not going to stop me from loving you. I even hold space for people that, you know, they don't have well intentions for me. There's a space for love in this world for those individuals, and I can have empathy for these people because I understand that they are probably dealing with their own share of trauma. And as somebody who is a mental health advocate, I know where that comes from. It also doesn't mean, however, that I yield on my love to myself. So I have learned the art of having boundaries. I have learned the art of allowing people to show you who they are and believing them, and to, you know, hold them in a space of blessing. But in short, I'm terming all of this as love.
Hmm. You just sparked an extra question. You get a bonus question.
Okay, sure.
That just made me wonder about when you were talking about boundaries and about the fact that you have been in places mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically that have helped you develop that empathy to put yourself in places to help understand where people are coming from, mm-hmm. which I have so much love and respect for. That makes me wonder what you are currently working through. What is a lesson that you feel like you still have coming your way repetitively that this life is teaching you this time around?
You know, I'm working through the idea that my worth actually has a monetary figure that can be calculated, you know, when it comes to the labor that I expend. It's like somehow I can understand that, like if you have a job, right? But it's a lot more difficult when you're working for yourself and you yourself have to give yourself a valuation. And I think that for those of us who are artistic, those of us who are entrepreneurs, those of us who are out building in ourselves, we have to develop a kind of belief in ourselves, but the ability to hold ourselves as valid, but also put some kind of an arbitrary dollar figure to that validity so that we can get paid for our work. And that is something that I have been trying to kind of work through, because I don't know necessarily where to place that all the time, because there's the element of I have a high value for myself, but I also understand, you know, market dynamics and things of that nature. And so it's a kind of complicated dance. I have been told in many instances, like, oh, you need to raise your rates. And then it's like, it's so weird to me that I kind of have a negative reaction to raising my rates. I never have a negative reaction to lowering my rates. And so I know that is a thing that I am still working through.
Yeah. I feel like that's a challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs that have that sense of, or almost like mates rates. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's like, well, I know you, so I'm going to give you a deal. But if you start to know everyone and you network and you give everybody mm-hmm. deals, like you're not paying yourself first. And you.
That's right.
Yeah. It's hard. Yep. I've balanced it with is. That before. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you had a message for everyone listening right now, what would it be?
You're more powerful than you think. And start with the things that are in your immediate awareness that come up to you. But expand your awareness. And what I mean by that is, especially when it comes to this anti-racism conversation that we're rooted in, you may look at this whole system of racism and say, you know what, like, I'm only one person. I can't change this whole thing. This is getting to be overwhelming. This is, you know, not something that I can really do anything about. And I didn't do anything, you know, hundreds of years ago to actually make racism, you know, a thing today and, you know, what have you. The thing is that everybody plays a role, you know, in being able to make life more livable for all humans and make it your mission to create a world that works for everyone. And whereas you see that the world is not working for everyone, and specifically it's not working for certain individuals consistently, start to do the work to inquire why. And if you can at least just do that, then you're on your way.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm so with you there. Okay, people need to know where to find you. They need to know your socials and your website and where they can follow along.
Sure. So I am on Instagram at Rooted Goddess. That's ROOTEDGODDESS. Rooted Goddess on Instagram. I also have my website, which is tiffanybowden.com. That's TiffanyBowden.com. I'm on Facebook too. You would just search for my name, Tiffany Bowden. You know, look for my picture. I'm African American with, you know, long dreadlocks. There's only one that generally comes up that looks like me. On my Facebook, we tend to have lots of long, drawn-out kind of discussions about inclusion as well. So if you want to hop into any of those dynamics, feel free to reach me.
Amazing. And you also have some courses coming up, correct?
I do. If you go to my Instagram, and it's that at Rooted Goddess, there is a link in the bio for my ally training that's going to be coming up. Within that form, there's also a way to let me know that you're interested in diversity and inclusion training. If you have an organization that is seeking diversity education, I've trained everything from mental health facilities to universities to tech companies, cannabis organizations, nonprofits, you name it. You know, I've done it and I'm doing it, and this is work that I love.
Tiffany, I'm smiling so, so big right now.
Great.
I appreciate you and your time so, so much. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me and sharing the mic. I appreciate it.
Tiffany, thank you so, so much for joining me on The Safe Haven. I deeply appreciate your time and your energy and the work that you do. To everyone listening, I recognize the privilege that comes with my platform, and I am committed to diversifying my content to create a more inclusive space with intention. If this episode has hit you in the heart, which I'm sure it has, please screenshot the screen that you're listening to it on your device, send it to all your friends, and share it on your social media accounts. Be sure to tag us so that we can personally thank you for it. Lifelong learning is something to adopt. Stay interested, stay curious, ask questions, but also accept the responsibility that comes with educating yourself in the areas that really matter the most, primarily understanding the importance of anti-racism, even if you're feeling a little late to the game. It is never too late to be a better person. Please check out Tiffany's courses and her educational platform. She's honestly a wealth of knowledge. Thanks again for sticking with us, and I will talk to you next week.